The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This podcast is brought to you by Simply Light.
Introducing Simply Light Lemonade. Can you hear that? That's the sweet sound of 75% less sugar and calories. We want to make sure you hear it's 75% less sugar and calories because it tastes so good.
Welcome to a special summer edition of The Feast. Last month, we brought you the story of Arizona's first cocktail with Joshua James and Phoenix's Clever Coy Bar and Restaurant. This month, we're taking a deep dive into the dark side of one of America's most iconic brands, Jell-O. Allie Rowbottom, a descendant of the family who purchased the patent for Jell-O over 100 years ago, has just written a moving portrait of the women in her family, the so-called Jell-O Girls. These were women whose lives were changed by the family's connection to this beloved brand, sometimes for the better, and more often for the worse. In her book, Jell-O Girls, A Family History, Allie weaves together a history of Jell-O itself, from its early days as an easy and cheap pantry staple for Depression-era housewives, to its heyday as a convenient, party-perfect food in the 1960s, and, of course, its transition in the 1970s and its increasing associations with diet food. Using her mother's notes and memoir, Allie traces the lives of the women in her family in parallel with the changing expectations of women in America throughout the 20th century, particularly in relationship to the kitchen. Already called rich and illuminating by the New York Times, Jell-O Girls is available beginning July 24th, wherever fine books are sold. And we recently had an exclusive chance to chat with Allie about her deeply personal and introspective work.
Tonight on NBC.
Will everyone in the cardiac surgical department please raise your hands? Thank you. You're all fired.
Based on an inspiring true story.
Any department who places billing above care, you will be terminated.
One doctor will break every rule.
Just tell me what you need, what your patients need.
To inspire a revolution.
Let's get into some trouble. Let's be doctors. Again.
From the network that brings you This Is Us, New Amsterdam, tonight on NBC.
This podcast is brought to you by Simply Light.
Introducing Simply Light Lemonade. Can you hear that? That's the sweet sound of 75% less sugar and calories. We want to make sure you hear it's 75% less sugar and calories because it tastes so good.
My name's Allie Rowbottom. I live in Los Angeles, California, and I'm the author of Jell-O Girls, which is a history of Jell-O alongside the history of the women in my family, primarily through a feminist lens. And I wrote this book because it was the story I sort of had to write before I could write other stories. It gnawed at me incessantly, asking to be written, especially because my mom was very devoted to the story herself. And as she got sick towards the end of her life, it felt even more imperative to write the book myself.
Absolutely. And I think, actually, you know, when I started reading the book, a lot of why you decided to write the book is actually kind of folded into the early part and actually even the end part of the book, you know, that kind of frame that you set about your mother towards the end of her life. And I was just wondering maybe if you, I don't want you to reveal too much about what's in the book, but maybe that element, that connection to your mom's writing that gave you perhaps a little bit of that impetus to write.
Sure. I mean, I think my mom and I were so connected through language and words from a really early age in my life. And so it became really natural that her obsession with this story would become mine, and that her attempt to put into language what it was that she was feeling about these intersections between Jell-O and illness and her life and her mother's life and my life, her failure to really articulate that would fall to me to sort of try to redo and try to actually suss out, I suppose. She read to me from a really early age, and I think more and more as I sort of think back on her life and mine and my life as a writer, I feel like her influence when she would sit with me at night and read was so supreme and so important.
And I think, you know, it's and as you were mentioning, you know, so much of this is you and your mom's relationship, your mom's life. And then, of course, as you were also mentioning, it goes back another generation to your grandmother's life. And these fantastic stories and such rich stories of these three women in some ways are, again, I don't want to use the term framed, but there's this underlying element, which is, of course, your family's connection to Jell-O, which I'm hoping you can maybe just give a very brief explanation to perhaps why the name Jell-O Girls is so appropriate in this instance.
Sure. Yeah. So great uncle by marriage bought the patent to Jell-O in 1899 for $450, and he bought it from a man named Pearl Waite, who had basically invented Jell-O specifically, which, you know, was taking already existent powdered gelatin and then adding flavor to it to make it, you know, the light and delicious thing we know of today. So Order Woodward bought that patent, and then my great-great-aunt Edith married Order's son, Ernest. And so I say in the book it was through luck and through marriage that my family came into the Jell-O fortune and the Jell-O legacy. But Edith and Ernest had only one child. And so my grandmother, Midge, was very connected to her aunt and very much sort of like a surrogate daughter to Edith Woodward. And that meant that, you know, not only was there that family connection, but we were very, or Midge and my mother were very close to Edith and to Ernest and to the whole Jell-O fortune. And then when Edith died, she bequeathed part of the fortune to Midge, and then it trickled down to my mother and now to me. And that's sort of how great, great legacies are passed down, I have come to understand.
And I think then it's so appropriate in your book, there's this, you present almost a parallel history of your family and specifically, you know, focusing on your, I mean, you do tell the story of your family's kind of origins with Jell-O, but also specifically focusing on your grandmother, your mother, and then you. But in parallel, there is the, I don't necessarily want to, maybe the right word is evolution of Jell-O, but the changing nature of Jell-O, both in your family's history, but also as it affects the town in which the major factory was located, but also within America itself. And I think that's such a fascinating multi-layered way of approaching it. And I was just thinking, how did that parallel structure kind of come about? How did you figure out how to organize those parts of the book, because I found that so fascinating.
Yeah, I found it to be a fascinating process too, because this book took 4 years for me to write, and most of that time was really just trying to figure out what structure to give it and what was important to the story. So Jell-O was always in there, but it became more and more of a character as I figured the book out and as the book revealed itself to me. But really the way that I came to tracing Jell-O with that historical lens was by working with my mother's memoir and writing her narrative first. And as I did so, I was like, oh, it's so interesting, like that, you know, she was in college and it was like the 60s, and what was going on in the broader culture during that period of time. So I started to ask those kind of questions. And then I started to think, like, well, what if I, instead of exploring what was going on in the culture at large, I explored what was going on in Jell-O and Jell-O's marketing, and used that as a mirror for not only my mother's life, but what was going on in the culture. So I could fold in cultural preoccupations, Jell-O, and my mom, and create this more unified story.
And I think it's so interesting because, as you were mentioning before, that this book has a very, forthright feminist lens, as you were mentioning earlier. And I think it's very interesting. You know, you are obviously focusing on the women in your family, and in some ways struggling or confronting ideas of femininity, roles, gender roles, things like that. And then the parallel with Jell-O is this change in its own role in the quote-unquote kind of domestic sphere and its relationship to femininity in America. And I was just wondering if you might maybe unpack a little bit of that, because I think the story you weave with Jell-O and its relationship to women in America is so fascinating of, you know, what do the advertisements and the recipes of Jell-O, how do they convey a sense of what the expectations were for women at given points in American history, mostly through the 20th century?
Sure. I mean, I'm sure that, and I discovered this sort of way of looking at history and thought, oh my gosh, this would be so fascinating to do this with other products, because I think it's probably quite common. But Jell-O is unique because it came about during a period of time when women, and, you know, this is still partially true today, but women were marketed to as the people who were in the kitchen. So, for example, when Jell-O first started its marketing campaigns around 1904, let's say, and introduced the Jell-O girl, which the book obviously takes its name from, the idea was that with the coming Industrial Revolution, women were losing their hired help to more lucrative factory work, and so were forced to enter the kitchen by themselves. So this idea of Jell-O as a convenience food, so easy that even a girl or a child could do it, was something that the brand really pushed in its advertising campaigns. Because really, I mean, and I was so fascinated to discover this, but women, and particularly women who were privileged enough to be to hire help, were suddenly aware that they had no idea how to roast a chicken or prepare a meal, really. So sort of where the book begins with its tracing of the marketing campaigns, but then we see, you know, the Depression comes and Jell-O shapeshifts to market itself as an efficient food stretcher, and the same goes for the Second World War, where, you know, rationing meant that sugar needed to be parsed and carefully doled out, and Jell-O was a good way to do that, or to, you know, use Jell-O instead of sugar. So we saw the brand instructing women primarily how to use it. And then later, you know, like say in the 1970s, we saw Jell-O attempt to market itself to sort of newly single women or independent women who were enjoying city luncheons. Over time, Jell-O also really worked to market itself, and still does today, as a diet food. The book goes through and sort of shows that progression and that Jell-O's sort of odd relationship with feminism, because it's not as simple as Jell-O just being anti-feminist. I think, you know, at times it tried to keep women in the kitchen or to urge women to stay in the kitchen. And then at times it was, you know, when that wasn't quite working, trying to appeal to women who would maybe be eating out. It's still evolving, as a lot of things are. But I, I think that the book is hopefully concerned with just showing that fluid and pretty intricate relationship between Jell-O and women's agency.
Mm-hmm. And I think it is an important element that you don't oversimplify it, that there is this attempt to change and reflect maybe developments in gender roles or, subversions of gender roles or changes to gender roles, and whether or not it's always chasing that change or it's meeting that change and its own successes and difficulties, I think is so interesting, again, paralleled with the personal histories of your mom and your grandmother and, of course, yourself. With the kind of added layer of being so fundamentally connected in this familial way to this product. And it's so interesting how Jell-O plays a role, and maybe it's not so much a character, but it's this presence throughout your grandmother and mother's life that's sometimes malevolent, sometimes sympathetic. It does change itself depending on the time in their life or the situation that they're going through, their own kind of state of mind and their own current, what's the word I'm looking for, kind of relationship to their family and their family history. I think that is a really fascinating element of this book. I mean, I'd love to know a little bit about how, you do, of course, mention it in the book, but your own experiences with Jell-O and growing up in this family. Just maybe if you could talk about some of your early memories with either your mom or just yourself of knowing that this product is part of your family legacy.
It's a funny thing to look back on because as a little girl, my mom would tell me stories about Jell-O and our history, but I'm not sure if it's this way for all kids, but it certainly was for me that I was so in the present and so immersed in my life and my reality that it just seemed like another story. And she had a bunch of like Jell-O paraphernalia, like an old tin with a Jell-O girl on it and some old like framed prints of old advertisements and stuff like that that hung in her studio. And I thought they were cool. I would look at them a lot. But other than that, I really only addressed the story or was aware of the history when I would tell my friends about it, like at school, if there were like, Jigglers served or that kind of thing, I would tell people and they would probably disbelieve me. So it was not until my mom and I went to Leroy, New York, where she grew up and where Jell-O was manufactured until the 1960s when it moved to Delaware. It wasn't until we went to Leroy for the celebration of Jell-O's 100th anniversary that I kind of got it, I guess. And again, like I just didn't really realize that there was an inheritance. I didn't realize really the connection until then when I was meeting people around town and seeing the Woodward tomb in the cemetery or seeing the giant portrait of my great-great-aunt Edith that hangs in the museum there, that kind of stuff that I like really acknowledged or understood our connection to Jell-O. My mother didn't make it, so it wasn't in our house a lot. It was just sort of a thing that I would eat out in the world, but rarely.
Again, getting back to the impetus to writing the book and kind of discovering, well, I don't know if discovering is the right word, but kind of experiencing your mother's own writing as she had written and kind of compiled as I'm not even going to attempt the pronunciation that you talk about in the book of her memoir, but it's
the memoir.
Memoir?
Yeah.
Memoir. There we are. The memoir. And I just love to know a little bit about the actual experience of you reading your mother's writing and kind of your discovery of her own experiences by her own hand, but of course, her reflections upon her mother, Midge, and, you know, her experiences as a mother and a wife and kind of her experiences in the family of Jello. You know, what was that process like of going through her writing?
I mean, it was kind of amazing. So my mom wrote her memoir for many, many years and tried and then failed and then tried again, and she was relentless with it. So she started when I was a kid, and when I was a teenager, she was giving me pages to read. So I was accustomed to her voice and her work, but it wasn't until right before she died and then after, when I was working on this book, that I really saw stuff about her writing that I probably blocked out before or was able to read and really understand and empathize with things that she had gone through that, I just was probably, as a coping mechanism, just not letting myself acknowledge or feel. For example, losing her mom when she was 14, I mean, I always knew that that had just profoundly shaped and changed my mother's life. It was, her grief was a presence in her life, and it was a presence in our relationship. But I just couldn't understand it until I lost her. And losing her was what helped me to really write her experience of losing her mother with sensitivity, I guess. It was at times jarring, I suppose, to read her understanding of stuff about my parents' marriage or different traumas that she went through. But at that point, I guess, she and I felt so... She felt like such a part of me that... I experienced it as sort of my own trauma, that there might be like something really wrong about that, I guess. But it felt that way when I was reading it. It sort of feels like something that has happened to me now, too.
You know, I think you really have brought your grandmother and, of course, your mother as well to life through, I think, this ability to empathize, as you were saying, you know, that through some of the shared experiences that these now three generations of women in the same family have experienced, you get this impression that you're not reading, when you read the accounts of Midge or you read parts of the life of your mother, Mary, something that is distant or removed. You get this very vivid emotionality to it. You get this very sense of these women's experiences and struggles and frustrations in some ways, in many cases. And I think that's a unique gift to be able to do that, especially pulling from your own history, but also pulling from, you know, your mother's writing, which, again, has this very personal connection. Was it difficult to write those elements? I mean, you were mentioning that there were some struggles, you know, when you were reading elements about your parents' marriage and things like that, but how did you kind of work through that process?
It took me a long time. I guess I ended up including one of the things about my mom's memoir that was challenging for her and for me was that she, and I think that this is really common, like I talk about this with my students a lot, but it's, she sort of threw in everything that had ever happened to her. And it can be so challenging to decide what stays and what goes when you're writing about your own experience because, you know, you look back on your life and one thing leads to the next thing and everything feels important in some ways. I mean, I think for me, one of the difficulties with working with my mom's material, but also something that I hope that I was able to do for her in a way in this book was I was in parsing the really emotional and true material from the sort of extraneous and then creating a narrative that of course left stuff out, but ultimately I hope gave a really clear and true portrait of her experience and her mother's before her. working with my grandmother's letters and was really, really interesting. I'd never been that interested, I guess, when I was younger. But then suddenly, when my mom was sick, I felt so compelled by my grandmother's voice, and it felt like reaching into the past to try to reclaim her in some ways. So that was a really amazing experience. She became round and deep to me in a way that she never had before, and I felt like I got to know her in a way that felt very special. I'm not sure if I answered the question.
I can only imagine the difficulty in trying to, when you have such a personal connection to these pages, trying to come up with a narrative and to try and, again, as you were saying, kind of sift through and see what can work that speaks to the truth of the story that you're writing and the history of these women's lives. And I think, you know, from reading it's very successful. I just was wondering, you know, what that process was like for you, because it doesn't seem like an easy task. That's all.
Oh, it was definitely daunting and overwhelming at times, and also just exhausting, I guess. I've spent a lot of time writing about the past and about sort of like traumatic memory and that kind of stuff. And I tend to not realize it until I'm done with whatever I'm working on. But it is so emotionally taxing to wade through, you know, your own trauma or somebody else's, and to put yourself in that frame of mind. I mean, especially because for a lot of this, I was looking at my mother's work after she had died and coming up with stuff that I wanted to talk to her about. And it was very bittersweet. Part of it was, you know, sort of like visiting her. Every day I would go to my computer to work, and it felt like sitting down with her in a way. So I was sad when it would end, but I also realized that I needed to release the project and put it out into the world in order to move on with my life.
Yeah, it's always important, that aspect of closure, right? You can work on a piece forever, but especially maybe in this sense, the publication does represent this way of putting it out into the world and then giving you space to move on with another project as well.
Yeah, I mean, I said this, I think, at the beginning, but this book just felt like the story. I mean, I think a lot of writers feel this way, but like the story that I had to tell before I could move on to others. It's comforting to me to know that my mom would be really happy to have her story out in the world. I think she would probably feel a little bummed that she hadn't written it. But I think overall she'd be really happy.
And I'm sure immensely proud as well.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the one other thing that I just wanted to ask about, you know, your process of writing the book and using your mother's writing, because as you read, or as I was reading the book, you know, there was this push and pull of the presence of Jell-O within all three of the lives that you touch on, your grandmother's, your mother's, and yours, and an element of trying to kind of get Jell-O, not really want to be part of the Jell-O family, trying to minimize it in some way, but yet Jell-O keeps popping up in surprising or kind of unexpected and paradoxical and in many times bittersweet ways. And I was wondering if you found that same popping up presence in your mother's writing, that even though perhaps, you know, it wasn't in the house as you were growing up, you know, it was this lurking presence or kind of character that's always in the background and when you were going through your mother's writing.
Absolutely. I mean, my mother's writing was so dark in so many places, especially in terms of her recollections of her adolescence after her mother died in Leroy, and how, which was where Jell-O was made, and most of her family still lived at that time, sort of her descent into mental illness, and then her decision to admit herself or to allow herself to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital. And Jell-O, like, because that time was so dark, but because she was living in a house and in a town that was so enamored with Jell-O and her family's connection to it, there was such a preoccupation with the contrast between her grief and her sense of just sort of being unmoored in the world, and Jell-O as this signifier of stability and light and dainty, delightful dessert, you know? So she was very preoccupied with that. And it did give me a lot of ideas as to how to address that contrast and address the way that my mother saw Jell-O as this sort of ominous presence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And again, as we were talking about before, paralleling that with its changing perception in kind of America and these changing, oftentimes very dramatically, gender expectations and gender roles, and the company attempting to either keep up or not really towing the line in some way, shape, or form, I think is a very interesting parallel. And I don't think we see enough of in topics that look at food history, and which is why I was so delighted by the way you incorporated food history with your own personal history and your family's history in the book. I think there was a quote that you gave in another interview that you said, food is fraught with symbolic meaning. And I thought that was such a wonderful phrase. There's, I think, no almost better way to sum up this book than food is fraught with symbolic meaning.
I feel like that will go on my headstone. Like, I definitely feel, so in the book, I go into just briefly my sort of adolescent and post-adolescent struggle with food and ultimately getting treatment for an eating disorder, and just looking around this table of women all having their individual emotional journeys with the food on the plate in front of them. Because, you know, at a treatment center like the one where I was, we would eat communal dinners and then process how we felt about the food. And looking around the table, you realize that I think probably for everyone, although it was very, very apparent at that specific table, but, you know, a piece of pizza or a plate of pasta or whatever it is, it's not just that. It's something deeper. And so, you know, we're all constantly walking around the world bringing our own symbolic or projecting our own symbolic weight onto the food we eat, for better or for worse. It's just sort of the way we are. And I think it can actually be quite a beautiful thing in a lot of cases. In terms of Jell-O, obviously, it's been a challenge for the women in my family. But it never ceases to amaze me how fraught food is.
And I think that's, you know, a unique success of this book, is to be able to talk and explore that fraught relationship on so many levels, that you have the fraught kind of national corporate level. You get into it as well with the fraught, complicated relationship between, you were mentioning, you know, the town of Leroy, like the town of Jell-O with Jell-O and its changing relationship. And then you have this very unique relationship with Jell-O through your own family's particular history with this food. And then, of course, yes, a personal encounter with, you know, a struggle with food and a relationship with food, which, again, I just find amazing that you have been able to layer this book so well, addressing each of those elements in turn and in such a vivid, full way. And I think that's absolutely a success of this book.
Oh, thank you.
I would love to know what your future holds now that this book is out, now that this is the book you needed to write before writing other things. What are the next plans? Of course, this is the awful interview question where you've done all this work and this book is just being published now and we're already asking. So what's next?
No, not at all. Actually, it's a funny question because this is all tied up in my second book, but as soon as I sold Jello Girls, I was like, oh, I gotta write the next one. Like, I have this window of opportunity, you know, thanks to a book advance and time to write a second one. And also, you know, there's something very freeing as a writer struggling for a really long time to, you know, get your work read and then to have someone actually pay for it. It's amazing. So I was like, oh, I could do that again. I actually have this tendency to torture myself by writing personally about my life, but I decided to write my second book on my, which is again sort of an interesting thing about lives, which is that I have a whole life that's not even in Jello Girls, but I grew up as a very competitive horseback rider. So I wanted to write a book that sort of talks, it's sort of part grief memoir, part exploration of competitive horseback riding, and also calling to task this idea of sort of a mythical bond between women and horses and the archetype of the horse girl in general. So the book, I still own the same horse that I had as a child. And with that horse at the age of 18, I ended up winning a world championship. So the book chronicles that history alongside a modern day or current narrative thread wherein I try to take that horse who is now geriatric back to the same show where we once triumphed and win again. And ultimately readers will discover what happens. But it was an interesting time in my life. My mother had just died. And I think I thought that if I went back and won again, maybe I could bring her back. So it's again, it's another sort of multi-layered nonfiction text that I'm still trying to unravel. But yeah, that's my next one. And then after that, I'm thinking I might like to write a novel because it is quite exhausting to continually go back into the past and dig around.
Yes, do something entirely fictional next time.
Yes. I'm really looking forward to that.
That's incredible. So we can look for, I assume it's not going to be called Horse Girls, but maybe it is?
No, I have no idea. I haven't, it's not even in that stage yet, but I hope somebody would like to publish it. We'll see.
Well, I mean, until that day comes, I think folks are going to be delighted by Jello Girls, which I should give the official information. It debuts when this episode comes out today, which is going to be July 24th. And I assume will be available wherever fine books are sold.
Yes, there's a digital book, and you can also, I read the audiobook, so hopefully readers like the sound of my voice. You can hear it on Audible or wherever you get your audiobooks.
Oh, wow. Now, you've just sponsored another question because I just love to know because I've never been able to ask a novelist, well, not a novelist, but a writer who's narrated their own audiobook. How did you find the experience?
It was actually really moving and incredible. I'm so glad I did it. I'm so glad they let me do it. It was exhausting. I mean, it's taxing to read your own work and to read anything really for hours a day. It was actually quite moving somehow. I'm not exactly sure why, but by the end I was crying. The producer was crying. Everybody was crying. So I enjoyed it. I really did. It was one of the best experiences I've had with this publication process so far.
Oh, my goodness. Well, now I'm going to have to go and get the audiobook.
Once again, that was Ali Rowbottom, author of Jello Girls, A Family History. Available today wherever fine books are sold. You can find out more about Ali on our website at www.thefeastpodcast.org. And if you're subscribed to our amazing newsletter, you've already been treated to a special additional Q&A with Ali, where she dives even deeper about her inspiration and motivation in writing this intimate personal history of the first family of Jello. Now, the newsletter is really the best place to get all of these extra bonus tidbits from our episodes. Make sure you're subscribed today. It's easy to sign up, and we promise, we only send out good newsletters. Find out how to subscribe by visiting our website. And that's it for this edition of the Feast's summer series. Stay tuned for our next special episode. I mean, we've already covered historic cocktails and the dark side of Jello. Who knows what'll be next?
Until then, I'm Laura Carlson, and this is The Feast.
The Podglomerate, a sonic universe.
Tonight on NBC.
Will everyone in the cardiac surgical department please raise your hands? Thank you. You're all fired.
Based on an inspiring true story.
Any department who places billing above care, you will be terminated.
One doctor will break every rule.
Just tell me what you need, what your patients need.
To inspire a revolution.
Let's get into some trouble. Let's be doctors again.
From the network that brings you This Is Us, New Amsterdam, tonight on NBC.